Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I thank you very much, especially since this paper, I cannot see anything into the audience. It's all dark there for me. But I figured that that entrance was required since I'm going to be talking about a topic that is very close to Scott Ward's heart, which is that of the court and tournaments and jousts. And I figured that since I could not bring a horse, I brought this and I rode in as if I was jousting with one of my colleagues, Ron Mellor, who also suffers from a sever or damage Achilles tendon, which is what happened on Thursday to me. I fell into a hole stupidly as I was walking home, and I am now in this condition, which is the most depressing thing, thanks that the chair of the president of the Academic Senate is a psychiatrist, and he was giving me therapy back there. Because essentially my teaching depends a great deal on movement and not reading a text, which I am not very good at it, but doing it extemporaneously. And now I am here, tied behind this podium, not knowing what to do. I am greatly honored to hold this lectureship as a representative of the North Campus. I am not foolish enough not to realize that most of my colleagues are as deserving or more so than I am. But I also would like to say that I am representing here not only the North Campus, but the South Campus as well. Because if I am here, standing in front of you, it's thanks to the work of Dr. Lum, who for 14 years have kept me going. Dr. Levinson, who for 14 years have kept me seeing things. For Dr. Schreiger, who helped me a great deal when I had this. And I hope Dr. Gamrat, who's going to fix it and allow me to go to Paris with 45 students in June and walk with them through the city. As Scott mentioned, this is a year of ups and downs, and it's been a very extraordinary year in many respects because of all the things that happened, good and bad. The medal, the Phi Beta Kappa lectures, my mother's passed away. I went to Cuba for the first time in 51 years. Then this lecture, the rupture, Achilles tendon. I told my doctor the other day, I just want to go into a corner and read Jane Austen. Please don't let anything else happen to me from now on. Now, I will... I cannot take my jacket because I have my microphone here. I put it in a pocket. I would like to begin this lecture as I begin all my lectures, as I begin every lecture that I give at UCLA, which is with evoking Walter Benjamin. Walter Benjamin, as you know, was an essayist, a sociologist, a philosopher, an extraordinarily insightful fellow who left Nazi Germany and committed suicide outside the Spanish border because he could not get in on his way to the United States. He writes two excerpts that for me are critical. The first one is related to this ghastly figure. This is a painting by Paul Klee. It's entitled Angelus Novus. And Walter Benjamin tells us that he has seen this painting and he likes to think of this angel as the angel of history. And the angel of history stands in a hill and he looks into the past and he sees in front of him all the disasters of history, all that terror of history that I wrote about it in a recent book. The catastrophes, the inequality, the genocides, all those things. And he wants to put a stop to that. But a wind is blowing from paradise and it has caught his wings and he's been propelled inexorably into the future. That pile of debris, piling highward, skyward in front of the angel of history, Walter Benjamin tells us, is what we called progress. In another excerpt, a shorter one, a critique of historicism, he tells us something that is very evident, which is that history is written by the victors. But he argues that essentially, in history, all the monuments of civilization are also at the same time monuments of barbarity, achieved and, in a sense, accomplished on the weight of the shoulders of the folks who toil endlessly. And I wanted to say that, and I wanted to bring this, because essentially what I'm going to be talking about is a magical world of the court, of tournaments and jousts. And I wanted you to remember that while all this incredible play was going on, all this fictional warfare, fictitious warfare was going on, Europe is essentially undergoing a terrible religious wars, that the conditions of the people below is growing increasingly worse, that the people in the New World are being massacred and exterminated. That is not part of the story that I'm telling you today, but it is essentially what lays at the bottom of this, what it is the context of what I'm going to say. So, with your permission, I shall begin. The origins of tournaments in Western Europe can be traced back to classical sources and to a sparse number of references of events that look like tournaments in the central Middle Ages. While these early mentions provide interesting glimpses into the genealogy of fictitious combat, the 12th century truly marked the formal beginnings of these traditions of artificial warfare that held such a powerful grip on the European imagination for many centuries to come. Closely tied to courtly culture and in symbiotic relationship with the great outburst of courtly literature in the 12th and early 13th century, the tournament laid deep roots in England, France, the Low Countries, and parts of Germany during the 12th, developing elaborate rules of engagement and pageantry in succeeding centuries. Most scholars have argued that the Iberian Peninsula was a latecomer to these festive martial traditions. I am not, however, fully convinced that such was the case. The intense contacts between Catalonia and Occitania and the familiarity of northern Castilians with French customs, thanks to the streams of pilgrims putting into northern Spain on their way to Compostela. And may I stop here and say that Karina Padilla has put all these images together and she magically produces them. I am not using any magic here, and she's going to be teaching for America for the next 2 years. So she's great and she's back there. Yes. So all these contacts may argue for the peninsula's nobility extensive familiarity with tournaments, jousts, and other such activities. The influential 12th century Fuero de Cuenca's description of judicial combats reflects, in terms of organization, choice of weapons, and linking of nobility and horsemanship, a close understanding of the tournament or joust rules and regulations. Regardless of whether the Iberian Peninsula share fully in the tournament in the 12th century or not, such arguments as to the origins of tournaments are not very relevant to my discussion here today. The reality is that from the late 14th century onward, the Spanish realms hosted and promoted an endless numbers of such affairs. While borrowing many elements from northern European tournament and joust culture, most obviously the heavy armor and the nomenclature of these festivals, Iberian realms also developed elements that were unique to the peninsula. In addition, although I use the word tournament to describe the fictitious combat between knights, though there were also carnivalesque imitations of these noble events among the commoners, for example, tournaments with commoners fighting with pumpkins or battles of eggs and the like, the term does not fully comprehend the full range of fictional warfare that served to showcase knightly skills, courage, and perseverance. In the Spanish realms, the proliferation of these ludic military displays in the late Middle Ages and in the early modern period appears, as was the case elsewhere in the West, to be connected with the popularity of certain literary genres. This connection between art and warfare remains an important one. And of all literary tropes, none plays such an important role in the tournament as love. The presence of ladies as spectators or as witnesses attests to the formulaic nature of these affairs. Most of the defenders and of the attackers in the tournaments, but similarly as well in the pass de arme, the joust, and the like, carry with them the colors of their respective ladies, the tokens or the signs of the prison in quotation marks, or enchantment usually by a neglectful female. The female gaze, not unlike the royal gaze, played a significant role in shaping the cultural contours of the tournament. It is impossible, in the time allotted for this lecture, to examine all the aspects of the tournament or all the martial games in late medieval and early modern Spain. Instead, what I would like to do is to present three different vignettes of some of these warlike festivals in the transition from the Middle Ages to the early modern period. These three vignettes are, one, a description and explication of the game of canes, which in Spanish is also called Juego de Cañas, and its relation to the running of bulls. Two, the great pageant that took place at Binche during Prince Philip, much later Philip II, visit to Flanders in 1549-1550. Three, a brief excursus on knights errant, the relationship between Burgundy and Spain, and a conclusion. In doing so, I hope to provide a window into specific aspects of Spanish culture, and more important, how this culture was represented. It is now time to begin. One, the Juego de Cañas and Bulls. On the very early morning of St. John's Day, 1595, the heir to the thrones of the Spain, Prince Philip, King Philip III, 3 years later, left the royal palace dressed in the Moorish fashion and riding a la jineta, in the Moorish style. Accompanied by 100 knights dressed in the same fashion, they rode to the streets of Madrid two by two and engaging in those equestrian maneuvers associated with the game of canes. When the Infante returned to the palace by 8 in the morning, Philip II, now confined to his chair by gout, not by an Achilles tendon, came to the window accompanied by the ladies of the court to see his son, an heir engaged in a lively game of canes. This was delightful to the ailing king. Johann l'Ermite, who described the event in his Le Pastant, tells his readers that it was, quote, one of the best he had ever seen in Spain. This small vignette, revealing of Philip II's long fascination with the Juego de Cañas, serves as a good introduction to our topic. Original to Iberia, as part of martial festive performance, where the Juego de Cañas, the game of canes, and the fictional battles between Moors and Christians, a topic I do not discuss here, but which I will be delighted to describe in the question and answer period. These two activities were quite distinct. The first one represented a display of horsemanship skills and required that the performers, for the Juego de Cañas was most of all a lovely performance involving elaborate maneuvers while on horseback with little actual violence as part of it. The requirement was that they dress in the Moorish fashion, ride with a Moorish saddle, a la jineta, and in the manner in which Moors rode the horses. Heavy armor and weapons were very much out, since they could only impede the careful charges and countercharges that were a part of the game. Instead, reeded spears with a weighted lower part, usually filled with sand, which could be thrown fairly harmlessly to a feigned enemy, and daggers carried on the left hand gave the game its sole military aspect. The Juego de Cañas demanded considerable skills, and it's quite surprising that there are many instances in which grandees and very high noblemen almost monopolize these displays. Participation in the Juego de Cañas did not preclude, of course, embracing as well the more dangerous heavy armored joust. Some donned the fancy Moorish clothes one day and the heavy armor the other. Although there were periods in which the Juego de Cañas barely registered in the chronicles, as for example in the court of John II of Castile with his heavy investment in pas de armes, jousts, and traditional tournaments, Spaniards on the whole were quite attached to the game of canes. No festival in the 16th century failed to exclude such displays of horsemanship. No royal entry or other festivities like them. And when Spanish princes or kings travel abroad, as Philip did to Italy, Germany, and the Low Countries in 1548 to 1550, or to England in 1554, the Juego de Cañas served as a special signature of Spanish uniqueness. Luis Toro Buiza, in his short monograph, Noticias de los Juegos de Cañas Reales, Notice on the Royal Game of Canes, provides a most useful summary of different early modern descriptions of the game of canes. Toro Buiza's discussions, essentially a survey of early modern erudite reflections on the game of canes, connects horsemanship. In many respects, these treatises are really more about horses and ridership than about the game of canes per se. Horse breeding and training with noble status and the elaborate equestrian exercises and ritualized performance of the game of canes. But this concern with defining good horsemanship and the proper form of riding in the Moorish style and engaging in the game of cane, and the treatise include very careful descriptions of the rules of the game of canes, also tells us volumes about the importance of the game of canes in the festive life of early modern Spain. The Juego de Cañas, beyond attesting to the long relation between Islamic and Christian knights in the peninsula, also reenacted the type of military strategies, that is to say, long distance raids by light cavalry, that dominated Spanish warfare until the wars against Granada in the late 15th century. It should not be surprising, then, that the Juego de Cañas and the concomitant Moorish dress became really popular only after Islam had been driven out of the peninsula in 1492, and Muslims were either forced to convert or were driven into exile. It seems almost perverse, a perverse contradiction, that Philip II, who sponsored punitive measures to forbid Muslims from dressing in the traditional garbs, from speaking Arabic, derives such pleasure and encourages nobles to play and dress like Moors. Moreover, the Juego de Cañas, Moorish in origin, overlap with the Castilian art of bojordo or bofordar. And some of you who have read Tristan by Gottfried von Strasbourg remember that one of the things that Tristan does is he goes in bohort, and so it's common to all of Europe. For example, the members of the bourgeois confraternities of Burgos went on a parade through the town bohordando, that is, throwing reed spears and leading the horses through elaborate maneuvers of attack and retreat. The Knights of Seville also received Alfonso XI on his solemn entry into the city in 1327 with equestrian games that included bohordos. These equestrian and military displays carried out by 14th century non-noble knights and lesser nobility were quite different, however, from the Juego de Cañas described by the chroniclers in the 16th century. Two elements were different. First, the game of canes became, as noted early, an activity mostly restricted to the high nobility, though occasionally Juego de Cañas were organized in which local knights displayed their military and riding skills. Second, the Juego de Cañas required a special and expensive garments. Participants had to dress and ride in the Moorish fashion. During the young Philip's visit to Italy, Germany, and the Low Countries, the game of canes played a central role in the elaborate feasts that marked the king's progress through Habsburg lands. In Milan, a long cycle of celebrations that included in chronological order a princely entry, the ephemeral art, that is to say, the building of arches and the like, marking the prince's visit, tournaments in the traditional style, theatrical representations, a foot tournament engaging Spanish soldiers, banquets, and yet another foot battle, concluded with a lavish Juego de Cañas and a comedy. Calvete de Estrella, chronicler of Philip's sojourn through Italy, Germany, and the Low Countries, takes great care in describing the event. On the Epiphany, 6 January 1549, the Games of Canes was performed in the palace courtyard to the delight of the princess of Molfetta, her daughter, and other ladies because, and I quote, it was a new feast, end of quote, and seldom seen in the land, that is to say, seldom seen in Milan. Here, Calvete de Estrella reminds his readers of the Spanish character of the Juego de Cañas, practiced mostly in Spain but carried abroad as a way of displaying Spanish military and equestrian skills. That the performers dressed strictly in Moorish fashion provided an element of the exotic in terms of the Moorish horsemanship, skills, and garments. In Milan, 6 squads participated, each manned by 8 Spanish noblemen. But these were not just any knights in Philip's cortege. The different squads were led respectively by the Admiral of Castile, the Duke of Cesa, the Marquis of Pescara, the Prince of Ascuti, the Count of Luna, and Don Francis of de Beaumont. It is obvious that non-Spaniards had acquired the skill for the game, or more likely, were given the nominal honor of leading the squad. But all the actual participants, that is, those who engaged in the actual maneuvers, were high-born Spaniards. The actual game was indeed a strictly Spanish affair. The list of participants reads like a who is who of the Spanish nobility, and everyone participating in the game of canes in Milan, although dressed in distinctive colors, wore the required Moorish garb, that is, a marlota or Moorish cloak, and caperuzas and capellares, hoods and hooded cloaks. The squad led by the Admiral of Castile came in with marlotas in white and purple velvet, and the capellares or hooded cloak were in purple damask with gold trimmings. Those accompanying the Duke of Sessa and his squad included several members of the prestigious the Cordoba family, wore marlotas of blue velvet with golden ribbons. The capellares were also of blue damask with gold adornments. Others came in gold and red, yellow and black, scarlet and gold, but all wore headgears in the Moorish style with plumes matching the colors of the garments. Philip, dressed in black and covered with furs, gazed with the Princess Molfetta and other worthies from the window of the palace. Such equestrian displays require a lifelong training in horsemanship. The transport of horses capable of engaging in these elaborate maneuvers, special saddles, and gear to be taken across the face of Europe, since the participants also rode a la jineta in the Moorish styles and wore special garments or set of garments that were to be used only in these performances. The Juego de Cañas thus became an important display of Spanish skills and of Spanish difference. As Philip traveled through Italy and the Low Countries, or as a particular display in Philip's voyage to England to marry Queen Mary. The Juego de Cañas, a spectacle that was particularly pleasing to Philip II, both as a young prince or as an aging king, played a prominent role in most early modern Spanish martial festivals. Valladolid organized, among many other festive performances, an elaborate game of canes when the king passed through the city on his way to the Cortes of Tarazona in 1592. The nocturnal parade of Zaragoza knights just after the king's entry into the city in 1585 included reenactment of the Juego de Cañas. A specially lavish game of canes was also held by Zaragoza's knights on 12 March 1585 in honor of the king's daughter's wedding to the Duke of Savoy. The successive entries of Anna of Austria into Castilian city as she traveled to her wedding with Philip II in 1570 drew the usual processions of craftsmen, military displays, triumphal arches, and similar other festive displays, as well as the inevitable Juego de Cañas. The queen witnessed a celebrated encounter in Segovia, the site of the marriage, where knights wearing distinctive livery form in squads, dressed in Moorish fashion, and armed with bordos, writ espías, which according to Baez de Sepúlveda, a contemporary chronicler, were used in Segovia instead of those used in the game of canes, and short knives, and they perform in her honor. A very large Juego de Cañas, involving as many as 380 knights, had also been part of the celebrations marking Prince Philip's wedding to the Infanta Maria de Portugal in Salamanca in November 1543. Jorge Báez de Sepúlveda, who chronicled Anna of Austria's entry into Segovia in 1570, made some poignant and doleful remarks as to the close relationship that existed, at least in Spain's proper, between the game of canes and the running and fighting of bulls. While carrying abroad well-trained horses, Moorish garments, reed spears, and other gear that defined the game of canes as part of a princely tour was logistically possible, bringing fierce bulls alone provided a challenge difficult to master. Running or fighting bulls and the Juego de Cañas were seldom, if ever, displayed together outside of the peninsula. But in Spain, bulls were ubiquitous presence in Iberian festivals and above all, closely associated with the Juego de Cañas, long a signal part of Iberian folklore and tradition. Bulls play a unique role in late medieval and early modern Spain. No royal prince, no royal or princely entry was complete without the running or fighting of bulls. Ranging from the carnivalesque bulls with torches on their horns or fireworks on their bodies to the more serious and deadly encounter between a man on foot or horseback and a full-grown bull, the spectacle wedded the aristocratic reed spear game with the popular and universal appeal of bulls. Perhaps the connection was far more between horse and bull. The former, the Spanish horse of Arabic descent, domesticated, tamed by the riders skilled, and forced to meet his fear. You could still see that if you go to see a rajoneo fight in Madrid or in Portugal, how wonderful these riders are to make sure that the horse faces the bull. The latter, the bull, a representation of irrational strength and bravery, an animal that could not be tamed. To return to the beginning of these discussions, Báez de Sepúlveda's description of the Juego de Cañas, held in Segovia for the reception of Anna of Austria in 1570, makes a revealing aside, commenting on Pius V's bull, the Saluti Gregis, 1567, which had forbid the running and fighting of bulls. Báez de Sepúlveda writes, and I quote, "In truth, banning display, happiness, regocijo, of bulls in Spain, one removes the people's most agreeable feast, and little by little, the Juego de Cañas will disappear, a game in which the Spaniards show far more honorable skills than in others." Báez de Sepúlveda's linking of the Juego de Cañas and the running of bulls is emphasized by the Spanish unique superiority in the Moorish game, something they could not necessarily claim in other martial games. But his comments also reveal the blending of popular and elite culture and the complementary roles of each of these activities. Having described in luxury of detail the very elaborate and intricate Juego de Cañas, in which 48 knights were divided into squads while dressed in Moorish fashion of different colors, Báez de Sepúlveda once again comments plaintively that, quote, "The game, the Juego de Cañas, looked very good to all lords and courtiers, but if bulls, running or fighting of bulls, would have preceded the game of canes, the feast would have been fully complete, because at the end, bulls are the best popular entertainment of all that for a long time have been performed in Spain." End of quote. Of course, the papal bull did not endure. In the narrative of Philip II's voyage to the crown of Aragon in 1585, 86, and in 1592, the Juego de Cañas and its association with bulls have been restored to the central place in Spain as Spain's autochthonous martial and popular play. We turn now to the spectacular feast that took place at Binche during Philip the heir to the throne of Spain and the Flemish and Burgundian possessions visit to Northern Europe in the mid-16th century. Two, Prince Philip's feast at Binche. I hope you will indulge me in my desire, and I know that there will be shown the time and so on, but give me 5 more minutes, to retell the story of the events that transpire at Mary of Hungary's castle at Binche in the Low Countries in August 1549. What took place there represents a watershed in Iberian festival, and as such, it has been often mentioned, even though within Habsburg land, ceremonies such as those at Binche, Milan, or Mantua took place outside the peninsula's borders. The feasts at Binche were very much like the celebrated feasts that took place at Valladolid in 1482, which I have essentially narrated and explicated to a luxury of details, but in many different ways they departed radically from the intent and meaning of them. How did they do so? As with other spectacles, the preparations for the fantastic festivities at Binche had long been in the making, and were well plotted to dazzle the young prince and future ruler of Spain and Flanders. While at Brussels, where Philip was received with all the solemnity due to him as the new Duke of Brabant and heir to the Habsburg Empire, it was an interminable royal entry, or princely entry, which included, among other things, camels, elephants, and an organ made with cats, like 10 cats tied there, and somebody pulled the tails of the cats, and the cats went meow, 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 meow. And here, the young prince at this great event in Brussels broke lances in a lavish tournament held in his honor with the Emperor Charles V, the Queen of Hungary, and France in attendance. During the banquet that followed, with the table set on the stage where Charles V, the Queens, and Philip sat by themselves, presiding over the august company, a knight errant came to the door, dressed all in green, his weapons broken and disheveled, his horse tired and mistreated. And I am quoting there. The knight went to the emperor with a sad and painful face, gave him a letter, and asked permission to place a placard or challenge at the door of the imperial castle. The placard, not unlike similar challenges to battle in 15th century Catalonia, invited all the knights present to a strange adventure at Binche. Although the young Philip may have not known in advance what had been planned, it is obvious that this theatrical representation had been previously agreed by the Emperor Queen Mary of Hungary and the humanists and courtiers who had devised such entertainment for the prince. The dramatic aspects of the challenge are all redolent with a culture of knight errantry and chivalrous behavior widespread throughout the late medieval Western Europe. Placards of defiances and knightly challenges were, as noted earlier, and as studied by Martin de Riquer, an important part of the highly charged atmosphere of peninsular chivalrous life. But before Binche and Great Fund, the prince had still to do the onerous duty of being received and feted by the cities in Brabant and Flanders. Finally, after an extensive circuit, arriving at Binche on 22nd August 1549. Binche, or Binche, served as a respite before the prince had to embark on yet another tour of Habsburg cities in the northern provinces. Ahead awaited Antwerp's joyous entrance, with more arches, emblems reminding the young prince of his duties and reciprocal duties to his Burgundian and Flemish subjects, more jousts, dances, banquets, juego de cañas, and all sort of other celebrations that accompany a princely entry. The adventure at Binche must have been a welcome interlude for Philip, a special moment that he might have carried with him as a cherished memory during those trying visits to his eastern kingdoms when his health was failing and his subjects were less prone to joyous entries. Binche, a village or a small town, belonged to Queen Mary of Hungary, Philip's aunt and Charles' beloved sister. The feasts that she hosted there lasted 8 days and were of such elaborate nature as to defy a comprehensive summary. An eyewitness to the event, Calvete de Estrella's description of the festivities held at Binche, takes almost 70 pages in the printed edition of his travel account. Besides Calvete's mention of the numerous mythological, classical, and chivalrous references, commemorative arches, he also provides lavish details as to the chambers and clothing given to the prince, the emperor, and the Queen of France by their host, Mary of Hungary. The festivities began with a foot tournament held on the feast day of San Bartholomew. French, Flemish, and Spanish knights engaged in fierce battle. A group of defenders met the adventurers or challengers while displaying their skills with a variety of weapons, pike, lance, axes, two-handed, and single swords. More of a melee than an actual tournament, a carnivalesque element was added when an artificial serpent, the ubiquitous dragon or tarasca of Corpus Christi processions in early modern Spain, burst into the procession, spewing fire from its nostrils and mouth. Two knights, dressed as savages or wild men, emerged from the artificial serpent, their bodies covered with ivy, and joined the fight. It was then, at the sound of drums and reed instruments, that Philip, accompanied by an entourage of great noblemen, all dressed in velvet scarlet with gold trimmings and golden silk calzas, leggings, came into the lists and challenged all the knights to fight with pike and sword. The prince fought against the Marquis de Berge with great effort and dexterity, or so Calvete de Estrella tells us. Before joining his father and queens on the stage, additional combats and dances follow the actual tournament. They continue until midnight, when the rey de armas, the king at arms, called the names of those to be awarded prizes for their valor, dexterity, and deportment. The tournament, as lavish as it was, would not have marked the celebrations of Binche as truly memorable. At the banquet and dance, always necessary accompaniment to all martial games, a letter was read to the emperor that reiterated the challenge and a story posted on the door of the imperial castle at Brussels. A panegyric to knight errantry, and borrowing freely from Arthurian legends, the placard and letter describe a fantastic adventure that all true knights would be eager to undertake. The letter described the power of a wicked magician and sworn enemy of chivalry named Nora Brooke. He lived in an enchanted castle, eternally covered with, quote, dark and thick clouds, end of quote, which together with the Fortunate Isle, the Dangerous Tower, and the Fortunate Pass, a pas de arme, served as a test for all knights errant. Because in this type of stories, there is never evil without a counterbalanced good, Queen Fadada, a lover of peace, good, and of all valiant knights, had placed an enchanted sword into a rock on a hill. The knight able to extract the sword from the rock will break the enchantment and deliver from captivity those poor knights languishing in Nora Brooke's captivity. Getting to the sword was not to be an easy task. To get to the sword and eventually to Nora Brooke's enchanted castle, adventurers had to meet the challenges of three successive pas de arme. The first, of Fortunate Pass, was defended by a knight named the Red Griffin. The second pas de arme was held by a knight of the Black Eagle, while the third test of knightly prowess, that of the Dangerous Tower, was sustained by the knight of the Golden Lion. The rules of this elaborate game also clearly set the sequence of events, that is to say, the order of the pas de arme. An adventurer would come to the barrier, blow an ivory horn. A dwarf will come to the barrier. The knight defending the pas de arme, in this case the knight of the griffin holding the first pas de arme, met the challenge. Only if the adventurer surpassed the skills of that first knight defender could he proceed to the second pas de arme and so on, to the point where the knight errant could then test whether he was destined to extract the enchanted sword from the stone and assail Nora Brooke. The spectacle, although it seemed to be taking place in an elaborate and extensive landscape, could in fact be seen in its totality from the windows of the palace tower. There, the emperor, queens, and prince gaze on the challenges, while a large crowd behind the barriers, perched on nearby trees and on other high places, gaze avidly on these displays. Numerous knights with names borrowed from fictional accounts, some of them even dressed in Moorish fashion, came to the different pas de arme. In some cases, the battles got so heated that several combatants were wounded. Pages upon pages, written by the meticulous Calvete de Estrella, describe the deeds and fictitious, and not so fictitious, battles of high Spanish and Belgian knights errant, including one knight named suitably enough for this very Quixotic adventure, Juan Quijada. One can see clearly what the entire narrative was aiming at. By the end of the second day, after numerous knights either failed to defeat the defenders or to remove the sword from the stone, a knight under the name of Beltenebros came to the test, defeating with ease all of the defenders in the three challenges and removing the enchanted sword from the stone. Beltenebros was, of course, none other than the young Philip, who now, wielding the enchanted sword, defeated the forces of Nora Brooke, broke through the gates of the evil magician's castle, and freed all the enchanted knights, longing there in captivity. Other equally bizarre celebrations, fireworks, dances, banquets, yet another tournament, an enchanted chamber with mirrors, disappearing tables, and a celestial crown completed the unforgettable experiences of the great feast held at Binche between 22 and 31st August 1549. After such extensive summary of what took place at Binche, a few comments are in order. At a time in which cruel religious wars agitated most of Germany and the Habsburg lands in Central Europe, when the Ottoman threat and Corsair activity menaced Iberia's Mediterranean shore, the emperor and his heir took time to play. At Binche, although serious jousting took place, a substantial number of great Spanish and Low Country nobles agreed to engage in an elaborate and tightly scripted role play. Borrowed from a whole chivalrous tradition, some of the elements of this dramatic performance seems to have been lifted shamelessly from 12th century romances and most of all from the 15th century Amadis of Gaul, Philip's favorite book. Tournaments were turned into art. The whole purpose of the dramatic representation was not only to please the young Philip, but also to enhance his authority. These were not innocent games. They were enactments of authority and prestige. Many of the knights engaged in the adventure could have certainly defeated Philip in a joust, and inflicted great harm on the prince. After all, as Henry II of France's fate shows, things could go very wrong at jousts. He was killed in a joust. Even kings could die. None of these things could have ever happened at Binche. The permanence and enduring hold of a chivalrous tradition in European political life did not end with Charles V and Francis I, who were expected to duel instead of going to battle. It remained not only an important part of the political imaginary, but it was powerfully inscribed in the ruler's mind. For all the descriptions of an older Philip as a bureaucratic king, he never relinquished the taste for these reenactments of chivalrous adventures. Spanish society thrived on them, and the pages of Don Quixote were filled with stories not unlike those acted out at Binche. One wonders to what an extent Cervantes, who would have certainly read Calvete de Estrella, borrowed some of his ideas from this narrative and turned it into fiction, what was already fictionalized reality. 3, knight errants, Burgundy, and Spain. Obvious from the previous section is the lively connection that existed between the Burgundian court and the Spanish realms long before the marriage between Philip the Handsome and the Infanta Juana in the late 15th century, leading to Charles V, Charles I in Spain, birth in Ghent in 1500, and the Burgundian-Flemish-Habsburg connection. Castile, above all, was intimately linked to Flanders, Hainault, and Brabant through intense trade connections. The export of wool to the Low Countries was already 2 centuries old by the time of Charles V's birth. But knights errant circulating back and forth between the peninsula and the Burgundian and other Western European courts provided indelible links between what one may describe as an international chivalrous brotherhood. The word in Spanish to describe knight errants and the title of one of Martin de Riquer's most enchanting books is Caballeros Andantes. And the Spanish rendition, I think, truly captures what these knights were all about. Knights that went wandering or traveling. These knights were not errant in as much as they always knew, unless we take Don Quixote as our only example, what their destination was. Courts that welcomed them with open arms. Brothers in arms willing to engage them in a spirited and often, but not always, fair combat. They found in the knightly counterparts abroad shared values, an understanding of courtly values, and romance. Before the Habsburgs, Spain fully participated and contributed substantially to what may be described incorrectly as a Burgundian ideal. In a world turned by civil wars, such as Castile, and the last bloody decades of that interminable struggle known as the Hundred Years' War, knights errant found meaning for their lives in the heady atmosphere of romance and service. After all, in a world closing in by the full emergence of national borders and embryonic national feelings, knights errant shared in an international fraternity that often transcended national allegiances and enmity in the battlefields. The new battlefields of early modern warfare had become very inhospitable places for heavy armored knights. When knights became soldiers and their loyalty given primarily to king and country, the medieval ideal began its slow but inexorable death. And as Don Quixote argued in Cervantes' masterpiece, religion is knight errantry. And Cervantes got it right. Knight errantry was indeed a form of religion in which the aesthetics of fictitious warfare granted a spiritual reward transcending those of religion. It is indeed redundant, as we come to the conclusion of this presentation, to provide too many more examples of the numerous Iberian knights from Portugal to Valencia who traveled beyond the Pyrenees with their empresas, their emblems, the tokens of the ladies, seeking liberation from their love's captivity and an opportunity to display their skills and courage. Similarly, knights from every corner of Europe pour into the peninsula, seeking adventures and knights with whom to joust. In that sense, Castile, and above all the court of John II, was a receptive place for such activities. In the crown of Aragon, King Alfonso V had moved his court to Naples, and the Italian world of the late 15th century was radically different from that of the, quote, waning of the Middle Ages, to use the incorrect but evoking English title of Huizinga's great work. Juan de Merlo, Gutiérrez Quejada, and Pedro Barba were just some of those wandering knights who fled the sordid politics of late 15th century Castile in search of honor elsewhere. Martin de Riquer tells a story of those peculiar Catalan and Valencian knights who, even if they did not go traveling abroad, did so through the bizarre deeds. On 20 January 1431, the knight Bernard de Coscon walked the streets of Zaragoza with an arrow piercing his leg in honor of San Sebastian. Johannot Martorell, 1413-1468, the notable author of the remarkable chivalrous romance Tirant le Blanche, traveled to England to the court of Edward VI, where he challenged his rival, who had probably dishonored his sister, to a combat to death. Miguel de Oris, a Catalan knight, traveled to Paris on 20 August 1400. There he posted a plaque challenging all English knights to battle on foot and horseback so that he could be liberated from his promise of prison of love. In the meanwhile, he walked the streets of Paris with a punzon, like an ice pick, piercing his leg tie, like me with an Achilles tendon, and so on. It was not to be removed until his deeds were accomplished and challenges met. It's a Spanish knight's errand to travel abroad in search of adventures. Foreigners came into Spanish courts in great numbers. Riquer provides an extensive list of foreign knights who, from the end of the 14th century onwards, came into the peninsula seeking deeds of arms. None could match either the influence or glamour of Jacques de Lelong, whose adventures were detailed in the well-known book Les Livres de Fées de Jacques de Lelong. A Burgundian knight, his adventures in the peninsula from 1445 onwards, and the later rendering of his adventures in a semi-fictionalized version provided a very successful marriage between actual deeds of arms and romanticized accounts. Besides his famous combat against John de Bonifacio, a well-known Sicilian knight-errant, at Philip the Good's court in 1448, Jacques de Lelong engaged in a brutal combat in Valladolid with Diego de Guzman, in which John II of Castile served as a witness and arbiter. The battle was fought on foot with axes. Diego de Guzman was badly wounded in his arm. The Chronicle of John II argues because of Jacques de Lelong's treachery. Yet, he had enough strength to wrest his opponent's axe, put him into the ground, and try to begin to strangle him with his bare hands. He would have done so, except that the king intervened and put an end to the combat. What had been only lightly glossed here is the ritualized nature of these fictionalized combats. Heralds and kings of arms, rey de armas, faraotes, percevantes, and others, terms in Castilians of such euphonic quality that they conjure by their sole utterance a world of magic, a whole distinguished collection of knowledgeable individuals, many of them known to us by name, called knights to battle, said the terms of combat, and sang the glories of knightly efforts. We hear how in 1608, at the swearing-in of Philip IV as heir to the throne, the oldest rey de armas, dressed with mace and coat of mail, explained what had to be done at the ceremony. Elaborate placards issue challenges and answer them, a form of quote-unquote public literature that wove one more layer of fantasy on these elaborate performances. Fantastic ephemeral constructions were built for the occasions. Ladies came to the events to gaze these heroic activities and to award the most worthy knights with prizes. The lists, the places of battle, were set in clearly delineated areas, a knightly sacralized space to which only nobles were admitted, where nobles could fight and die. Those on the lowest social ranks of society looked only from the outside with awe and wonder. Expensive cloth, usually a scarlet cloth, adorned the site of tournaments and jousts. Little change occurred in the transition from the late Middle Ages to the early modern period. Although warfare had radically changed and large battles had become killing fields, the high nobility still embraced that fictionalized life where gunpowder, longbows, and other nasty things had no place. These jousts and martial games were intricate, dramatic representations, whether the reenactment of Chrétien de Troyes passages in his Arthurian cycle, or of the Amadís of Gaul, or as it was the case with the Juego de Cañas, deeply inspired by Hurtado de Mendoza's Guerras de Granada, kings, princes, and knights imitated art. But the art was in itself a form of alternate reality. Chivalrous romances, literature, tournaments, and the like serve as a form of articulating power, a limited power at best, of reminding the crowds standing outside the barriers of the aristocratic and ritualized space of combat, of the importance of social hierarchy and martial skills. The church played no role. Priests were not wanted unless they were to gaze admiringly on these events. There were no blessings of arms, no confession pressing in these chivalrous exercises, and the drama and fantasy of it all capture every one of high standing equally. In a great tournament held in Burgos, a city about which I know a great deal, in 1424, to receive John II for the first time into the city. The city had all kinds of arches and celebrations, and they chose a defender. The defender who was chosen was Don Pedro de Cartagena. Don Pedro de Cartagena defended the pass so very well that he won some awards for his deportment and courage and skills. Don Pedro de Cartagena was born a Jew. He was the son of Shlomo Halevi, the great rabbi of Burgos, one of the most learned rabbis in all of Iberia in the late 14th century. In 1390, he converted to Christianity. He went to the University of Paris. He took a degree in theology, went to the papal court at Avignon, came back to Spain, became the Bishop of Cartagena, and then was elected unanimously as Bishop of Burgos. Talk about social promotion. His son, born a Jew, the son of a Jew, was so deeply, even though he was a very aristocratic Jewish family, was so deeply immersed in the chivalrous culture of Spain and of Western Europe that he was chosen to represent the city in this event. And he did so very well. And of course, in the celebrations of Burgos, there were also bulls running and fighting, only in Spain. Thank you. So, I take questions. Sandra. I don't see a thing here.
Thank you, Teo, for a wonderful lecture.
Oh, thank you.
And for really bringing all those medieval traditions that we've heard about and read about and seen suits of armor in the past, bringing them all to life. It was just wonderful, putting it in a cultural context for us. We have some time for questions here.
You mentioned twice Arthurian influences.
Yes.
And then you mentioned that the challenger at Binge was all in green and disheveled. So that raises the question whether there's any connection with the Green Knight who fights Sir Gawain in the greatest of the Arthurian poems.
That might be it, although this knight errant, yes, absolutely. I should have pointed that out. Green is not a likable color in the Middle Ages, and green is a color of infidelity. So a knight dressed in green, I was just talking about that in my class this morning, a knight dressed in green is someone who is proclaiming his infidelity. And of course, the story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is a wonderful one, and it's a terrific story, which is the Green Knight comes in to challenge the knights, and he challenged Sir Gawain and all the knights at the king's court to chop his head, and 1 year from now, I will come back and chop yours. And, you know, they chop his head, he picks up his head and goes back. So that is a very good idea. But of course, the knight errant here is disheveled, dressed in green, which is a color that knights will not choose because he's showing all the incredible pain that it was to be in the hands of that evil magician, Norrebrook. But it's a wonderful reference, yes, indeed.
Thank you. We have a question here. Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Were there duels in Spain during this time? And did the culture of tournaments bleed over into actual honor combat?
Oh, absolutely. Duels are dime a dozen in Spain. They are banned because essentially they are an attack against royal power. But duels, especially those of you who know Madrid, Paseo de Recoletas was a favorite place for people. Behind the monastery of the Recoletas in the 16th, 17th century, there are duels. In the Middle Ages, duels are allowed and usually held in the royal court. And it's a challenge to death. And they are not a judicial duel in the way in which the wonderful book by on the last judicial duel in France that has that my goodness, I'm having a Eric Jaeger, my good friend Eric Jaeger, wrote, these are not judicial duels, these are simply questions of honor. And Martorell is asking the man who has essentially violated his sister to come to England to fight, because the king of the Crown of Aragon is not very keen on this duel. But they go on throughout the Middle Ages, into the early modern period, and into the 19th and 20th century, as they do elsewhere in Europe. They are questions of honor that have to be solved by combat. Thank you very much. Abundant amounts of drink. That's what we need.
Teo, I want to thank you.
No Vicodin, no...
I want to invite everybody to join us on the patio outside Schoenberg for a reception. Teo, thank you for a wonderful lecture.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.